Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm hoping that my good buddy Red Beckman is here with me. Red, are you there?
I is here.
Well, Red, our guest Wilton Strickland is with us as well.
Great,
Wilton. If you don't mind, I'm going to take just a moment. We like to start this show out with a prayer, and
sure.
If everybody would join me, I'll open us in prayer tonight. Almighty Father God, we just come before you and honor you as the creator of this universe. We recognize that it is you that is the source of all truth and that can sustain us. And we depend upon that, and we rely upon your promises. And we invite your spirit to join us tonight in this show. And this, I pray that the message that we put forth is in your will. And we just ask you to go before us in everything that we do and everything we say. And in the name of your Son, Yeshua, we pray. Amen. Well, Wilton, welcome to Walls in Our Minds.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why don't you you give us a little bit of background on who you are and what you're up to, and maybe what prompted you to move to the big sky country of Montana?
Well, I'm an attorney. I've been in private practice for about 10 years now, and both my wife and I were born and raised in Florida, but to tell you the truth, we had about enough of it. It had changed a lot, and for various reasons, we just weren't happy there anymore, so we decided to look somewhere else, and we settled on Missoula, Montana. It is beautiful here, and it's one of the more intelligent decisions I've made in my life. Basically, I was here last February to take the bar exam, of course, and I ran into a young man named Timothy Baldwin. Now, it just so happens that Mr. Baldwin has his own website called Liberty Defense League, and he and I started talking, and he is also a Florida attorney, coincidentally, and we agree on a lot of these issues, and so he invited me to submit some articles to his website, and I've been doing that for the past few weeks. And I guess that's how you found out about me, is because somebody read one of my articles or republished it, and now I'm here on the show, and I'm very happy to be here because these issues are very important to me, and I suspect they're important to a lot of people who might be listening. So it's good to know that there are people to talk to, and we can try to come up with solutions to what are very serious problems for our country.
Well, now, you know, you have Red Beckman, the Fighting Montanan, online with us tonight. So Red, I'll let you extend a warm welcome to our new Montanan.
Yes, I call myself a Montanan. I'm more or less transplanted out here in the state of Washington. I guess until I die, because I was in real poor health. And when you're young and you're raising your family, you're the boss. But when you get in your second childhood, then your children become the boss. And so they decided that mom and dad should be out here closer to family, because we raised four offspring, and they all left Montana. Not on my recommendation, I can assure you, because I love Montana, and it's in my blood, I guess. And I'm just so glad to hear that we've got a transplant from Florida who is an attorney who thinks somewhat as we do, apparently. And And, of course, you're going to find that in western Montana, you probably found this out, the tremendous number of very solid patriotic Americans. And I'm just wondering, were you in Missoula back in May of this year when they had the Liberty Convention at the University of Montana?
I was indeed, and as a matter of fact, I attended some of that convention, and I had the opportunity to meet Timothy Baldwin's father, who is Chuck Baldwin, who was a speaker
yes.
at that event.
He was there on Friday night, and then I spoke the next morning.
That was a wonderful event, and I was happy to see that there are so many other people who share my sort of concerns about these problems and who want to think outside of the box. I actually think the program title here, Walls in Our Minds, is very apt because I think a lot of us had to overcome certain walls in our minds to come to the troubling conclusion that we can't just go to the ballot box and expect things to change. Our problems are a little bit too deep-seated for that, so it's going to require something a little bit more demanding, a little bit more creative. So I'm glad that we can try to figure out what that might be.
You will have an opportunity to meet the lady from Hamilton, Mona Doctor. She has lit quite a fire across western Montana and even going into eastern Montana. I was at Hamilton, Montana, September, a year ago. The middle of September for a meeting, and they had about 500 people at a meeting there in Hamilton. And that's exceptional for, you know, no more population than we have. To have 500 people show up for something like that is rather significant. And Mona is a gal that she's a transplant from California, of course. She's been in Montana for some time, but she has to catch up on her Montana history, and I hope you try to catch up on Montana history. The Montana vigilantes, I cite them pretty regular. How that the Montana vigilantes. We had an elected sheriff back in 1863. He was elected by the people in the Virginia City Bannock communities. And I hope you get a chance to visit Virginia City. The problem is the tourist season is about over, and the town kind of dries up after tourist season. But the history is there, and the people gave the sheriff, they gave their power to the sheriff to maintain law and order. The sheriff was a crook. He was the head of a gang of outlaws, and it took some time for the people to figure out what was going on. But when they did, the people took their power back, and this is a precedent. For the state of Montana that I hope people pick up on, because what politicians and what the people themselves don't understand is that, and of course you go to the state constitution of every state, I don't think there's any exception, they all began explaining how that all the power emanates from the people. And so the problems that we have in this country right now have come about because we the people have allowed the misuse of our power, we the people's power. And
Absolutely.
We have to take it back, and because they are not going to give it back, they're not going to give us our power back and say, here, we're sorry that we usurped your authority and your power and misused it. They're not going to do that. It's going to have to be, we're going to have to take it back. And of course, the jury and the grand jury, I've been preaching it across Montana for a long time. I ran for governor first in 1980, again in 1988. And the polls showed me winning that. And of course, I always ran as a Democrat. And of course, as time goes on, you'll hear about what I did to the other Democratic candidates. They accused me of not being a Democrat. They said I should have been running as an independent or a libertarian. And so I explained how that I was a Jeffersonian Democrat.
Now, that probably caused them to scratch their heads.
What?
That probably caused them to scratch their heads a little bit.
Well, I said, I'm a Jeffersonian Democrat, and if the other candidates, if they don't agree with Jefferson's political philosophies, I have to assume that they are probably Karl Marx Democrats. This caused a certain amount of misery for those people.
And you make an excellent point. I mean, first, yes, it's true. The parties have totally swapped their identities over time. The Democrats used to be the party of Jefferson, the party of limited government and decentralized power, and it was the Republicans who originally wanted to centralize power in the vein of Alexander Hamilton and Henry Clay, and they reached their, I guess, apotheosis with Abraham Lincoln. And a lot of people forget that history, and they think, well, Republicans are in favor of small government, aren't they? Well, they might say that occasionally, but that's never how they've governed.
I've been trying to communicate with some of these people in the Tea Parties because they're just stumbling around, and they're starting with little or nothing in the way of real background of our system, our history, and all of that. And I would like to see these Tea Parties, of course, retain their autonomy locally and such, rather than all get under one big massive head and become top-heavy like the NRA and some other things we know about.
I think that's a very valid concern. I am a little bit concerned about the Tea Parties because there's already a very obvious movement afoot to kind of hijack them and co-opt them, and you can see that happening with the upcoming election cycle. And to tell you the truth, I think maybe one of the worst things that could happen is if some Tea Party candidates won and then persuaded everybody that real change is on its way simply because a few of those candidates won. It's going to lull people into thinking that, we can just do as we did before, be on remote control as citizens, just pull the lever every November or so, and things will be okay, which I think is an illusion. We've been down that road before, and it's not going to change anything.
Yeah, there's a program is on. You can go to Google. There's several websites that have picked up on it, and they run it. It was a tape, a video that I did in 1993 for a Southern California organization.
LA Lawman.
Yes, LA Lawman is the tape. It's a two-hour tape, but the last 30 minutes was kind of awkward because they had it professionally videoed, but then they didn't plan on a question and answer period, and so they didn't have a mic out for the people that were asking questions and that. But there's 90 minutes there explaining what I have been teaching now for 35 years, and I hope you get a chance look at that because the Fully Informed Jury Association of out of Hamilton, Montana, or Helena, Montana, you're probably familiar with them. I hope you are.
Yes.
They're a national organization and originated right in Montana and came about basically because of what I have been teaching all these years. If you can watch that L.A. Lawman tape, it'll do a better job of explaining and showing you what I try to teach. And I've never been challenged, saying that I am inaccurate, that I'm off base or whatever. But the establishment out there that's anti-American and just power mad, they want to usurp every bit of power that we've got. They took me serious enough to where the vote fraud that we had in 1988, when the polls were showing me winning that primary, the vote fraud was so massive. You would have thought that Chicago could come and learn from what we were doing in Montana. It was serious, and I'm sure it has not changed. We collected the documentation, we investigated, turned it over to the Secretary of State. He promised to do something, and there was nothing done whatever. And it's as bad or worse today than then. So that's just one of the areas where we've got our work cut out for us.
I can tell, and I do look forward to learning a little bit more about that. And you point out something that I totally agree with. For a long time, when people such as us try to talk about these ideas, the usual response is dismissiveness, that, oh, well, that's just crazy talk. There is never an actual debate about the ideas or the facts or the history. But at least one good thing I think that's happening now is that a lot of these points that we try to make can't be so easily dismissed. You see a little bit more discussion happening, a little bit more debate is creeping in, so I think there is a little bit of cause for hope. We're seeing a little bit of progress.
It's going to get more so as this economy continues to deteriorate and more people are out of work, losing their homes, and there's something about the kind of trouble that we're having in this country. It gets people to where their hearing is so much better. And they will pay more attention today than they would even 3 or 4 years ago.
Absolutely. And there is a danger that I'm afraid of. If things get really bad really fast, then that might provide an opportunity to the opposite extreme. It might provide an opportunity to those in power to hit the gas, to do more of what they're doing, saying that they need even more power to save everybody from this crisis. And it could plumb the depths of martial law or anything else. So there is some opportunity here to reach people and get them to think seriously about these questions that have been ignored for so long, but then there's the opposite danger that it will provide an opportunity for even further abuses of power, the likes of which we've never seen before.
Yeah, I started to tell you what I was trying to get across to some of these Tea Parties. The Tea Party people, they need to organize enough to where they can send out teams of half a dozen people with at least one person that's a fairly good speaker in a public setting, and they need to go to every single political function between now and election. And when they have an opportunity to question, they need to, challenge the candidate or candidates, say, now, we voted for a Democrat in 08. After he's elected, we find out that he is a Karl Marx Democrat. And we were not told. We were not given enough information about this, and the American people need to know that there are different kinds of Democrats. This is the weakness. This is the problem with party politics. You don't know just putting a label on them that they're a Democrat. They can be just about any kind of a radical political philosophy, and the same goes for the Republicans. But we need to educate the American people that when they say they're a Democrat, that's not enough. We want to know what kind of a Democrat they are. We've got to get that across to the American people that they need to know what kind of a Republican or what kind of a Democrat that we're having to deal with.
I agree.
Yeah, I just think it's something that the Tea Party people could do that could be very, very effective across the country.
It will be challenging because for a long time, political discourse in this country is dominated by personalities and the horse race aspects of it. That's what intrigues people the most. When you start talking about actual ideas, people tend to switch off. But as we said before, because of the extreme circumstances we're in right now, hopefully that'll get people to think a little bit more deeply, to go beyond the surface of the smiling faces and the blow-dried personalities and get into some of this stuff.
Terry, where are you at?
I'm listening to you guys have a good conversation. And I'm wondering about these books. I'm used to having some knowledge of these books, but I found out about them so recently that I haven't had a chance to start reading them yet. So I'm looking forward to Wilton giving us a little bit of a taste of what's in the binders.
Sure, and there's no shame in not being familiar with the books. To tell you the truth, they've been off the radar screen. I wrote them several years ago. I tried but could not find a publisher who wanted to publish them for me, so I decided to self-publish, which is always a dicey venture. But I felt very strongly about these things, and it didn't seem anybody wanted to talk about them, so it was an effort to get all of it off my chest. And basically, the first book, it's called Unlawful Government, Preserving America in a Post-Constitutional Age. I try to summarize as briefly and as clearly as I can the ways that the modern federal government has totally taken itself beyond the confines of the Constitution that brought it to life. The Constitution is sort of like the corporate charter. It is the founding document, and it is an agreement among the states to delegate very select, discrete, enumerated powers to the federal government. Any power not delegated is a power that cannot be exercised. Yet we find the federal government in so many different ways exercising powers that were never delegated. And so what I do in the book is I talk about each major branch of government, the courts, the legislature, the presidency, and even the bureaucracy, which is, of course, the unofficial fourth branch, and I talk about how they are doing things that they have no warrant to do. Just to give a brief summary, I don't want to get too deep into it and deflate anybody's desire to actually read the book, but with regard to the courts, we've seen an example of this recently in Arizona and in California. The Supreme Court and the lower federal courts have taken it upon themselves to become what is called the perpetual censor. That was a term that the Supreme Court itself used shortly after the adoption of the 14th Amendment. The court at that time said it did not want to have a veto on all local laws. That would be too dangerous. It would upend the constitutional order. Well, as time went by, unfortunately, the philosophy changed. So now you have a court system that views itself as the ultimate arbiter of the Constitution and having the power to trump what the people want to do domestically in their own states. And it has gone so far beyond what the 14th Amendment was designed to do, it's really quite, I don't know whether it's sad or funny or maybe a little bit of both, but the 14th Amendment was designed to ensure that the recently liberated slaves enjoyed all the civil rights as white citizens, that they could enter into contracts, own property, sit on juries, and all of those things. But now it has taken far beyond that. It's been ripped from that historical context, and apparently it means that, for example, a woman has a fundamental constitutional right to have an abortion, even if her community thinks that it's something they don't want to condone, that homosexuals must be allowed to marry, even if the community does not want to acknowledge that form of civil union. And what makes that decision especially strange is that there was no ban on gay marriage in Proposition 8. Gays were free to marry if they wanted to. It was just that the people of California decided they did not want to extend their recognition of those unions. Yet even then, we have a federal judge saying, no, the Constitution, the same Constitution that for over 200 years allowed criminal laws prohibiting sodomy, required them to acknowledge these unions. So it's absolutely ridiculous. The courts have decided they can amend the Constitution, not merely enforce it under judicial review, but change it over time. And this totally disregards the Article 5 of the Constitution, which sets forth the process of amendment, where we the people, through our elected representatives, have a right to decide how to change the Constitution. The courts ignore that, they ignore us, and they claim the right to decide how society has changed. So not to belabor the point, but just moving along quickly, the rest of the book deals with, for example, the legislature and how Congress spends money on all kinds of projects it has no power to spend them on, that it regulates us in ways that the Founding Fathers would have found abhorrent. And we also have, for example, the presidency that now goes to war without a congressional declaration of war, that enters into executive agreements that are basically treaties that have the force of law but do not have any congressional consent attached to it. So those are just some of the examples, and that's how the first book sort of progresses. It talks about all these different examples to make people aware of what's going on around them.
How many books have you put out, Wilton?
Well, there was the second book, which I wrote just about almost 2 years ago. It deals with the world stage. It's called Unlawful Government Again, and the subtitle is The Gathering Threat of Global Hegemony. Now, the purpose of that book was to point out how the United States government is trying to expand its power on the world stage, much the same way as it did within the United States, that there is a movement afoot by the political class, not only in the U.S., but in other countries around the world, to consolidate that power, because they don't like the fact that there is competition among nation states. We live in a time when there are almost 200 countries, and there are more being created every day, because secession is actually very popular. People don't want to be governed by elites in faraway places. But, of course, the political class is very scared of this, and so I have documented the various ways that they are consolidating their power, sometimes by military invasions, as we're all very familiar with in places such as Iraq and elsewhere, but also in catchphrases such as human rights. We can all agree that human rights are a good thing, but the government likes to monopolize that term and assign it a particular official meaning that is actually quite different from any sort of rights that we as Americans are familiar with. And, of course, even a word such as democracy. Democracy is another word that is used to justify invading other countries and restructuring their governments to make them more friendly to the United States, when, in fact, we've seen that real democracies are often toppled because they weren't friendly to the United States. So the second book goes into those sorts of topics, and it argues that the same tendencies we saw within the U.S. are happening on the world stage. And I think that President Obama, he came into office after I wrote the second book. He has pretty much continued the same trends that I was talking about in the Bush presidency.
I think I need to inject something here that we need to keep in the back of our minds at all times. As we attempt to try to salvage something here out of this mess that we're in, about 25 years or so ago, I went to the county courthouse there at Billings, Montana, and I read the entire case where the U.S. Supreme Court took the Bible out of the classroom. The Supreme Court took prayer out of the classroom in 1947. They took the Bible out in 1963. When I walked out of that courthouse that day, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt in my own mind that the federal government as we know it was not going to survive its mistakes, for the simple reason that the first and second commandments that God gave Moses back there in Exodus, the 20th chapter, thou shalt have no other gods before me. That's what our God was saying. And then he goes on and he says, you don't have any graven images or anything, because he says, I am a jealous God. I anticipated the coming down of the USSR, simply because the USSR, when the Bolsheviks took over in 1917, one of the first things they did was say that there is no God, no creator God, and that the state would take care of the people and be their God for all practical purposes. I knew that the USSR would go down simply because I knew that our God is a jealous God and that it would happen. Now I know without any equivocation whatever, I'm absolutely convinced that this federal government that we know of today is in a self-destruct mode, and it is self-destructing. But that doesn't mean that I am going to quit what I'm doing, for the simple reason that ignorance is the glue that holds this thing together as long as it has. It's the ignorance of the large masses of the American people, and that ignorance, of course, was taught and implanted in the American people, in the schools, and the government churches, and so it's held together longer than the USSR. But as we go along with decisions like the California case that we just saw and such, I really believe, I'm convinced of this in my own mind, because I am I'm not a believer in the Christian faith. I'm a knower. There's a difference between a believer and a knower, and I'm a knower. And so, I think we have to kind of keep this filed in our minds, in the back of our minds, that this is a high probability that we're going to wake up just like the Russians did one morning and turn on the news and discover that the USSR had been dissolved overnight. And it could happen right here.
That reminds me, the past few weeks I've been reading something that's very captivating. It's James Madison's notes of the Constitutional Convention back in 1787. And mm-hmm. there's a very notable portion of those proceedings when somebody stood up, I don't remember which person it was, and said that they were having all of these difficulties. Maybe they should pause for a moment and reflect on just these sorts of deeper, more meaningful issues. And
it
have
was
a
Ben
prayer.
Franklin. Yeah.
Ah,
it was
okay,
Ben
thank
Franklin.
You. And that maybe if they would reorient themselves to that, I guess, pole star, that they would find their way and they'd be able to chart the right course. And I think that's a very instructive episode because it does underlie our entire conception of government in the United States. We believe that our rights don't come from other human beings. They don't come from people in positions of authority. They don't come from presidents or governors or legislators. They come from God. They are inherent in us as a gift from God, and they cannot be taken away from us by anybody else. And naturally, the government, any government, dislikes that sort of attitude because it sets up a competitor. The government doesn't want any competitors. It wants to be in total control. And so we've seen a steady increase of government power that parallels a steady decrease in religious faith or knowledge, as you put it. And that's no surprise. And it's going to keep getting worse unless we turn around and reexamine first principles. And the first principle here is that our rights are immutable. They can't be taken away. They are inalienable. And any government, I don't care if it's duly elected or otherwise, any government that tries to transgress against those rights is not worth obeying anymore. And I think that we have gone into that territory. We have a government that disobeys the written law that we put forth in the Constitution, but it also disobeys the moral, unchangeable, transcendental law. And so we have to ask ourselves, what is the right thing to do at this point? And personally, I think the best thing we can do is just to withdraw from these activities, from the election process, from all of this I guess, all, the entire public sector that has gone down this path, and maybe either look to our states, look to our communities, look to our homes for guidance instead of looking to another politician running for federal office.
Can I come back to your definition of hegemony?
Sure. Hegemony, in the sense I was using it, means absolute control or unified control. On the world stage, we have a lot of different nations, and we have international law, which has been around for a long, long time, which says that basically the rules are set forth by what the participants want to do. In other words, we as the United States can't be bound by something unless we agree to it, unless we enter a treaty or unless we participate in a certain custom. Well, that's exactly what a hegemonic power dislikes. The hegemonic power that we see in the United States government now, and which is sort of coming together on the world stage, does not want to have to yield to decentralized power in nation states or in local communities. So the gathering threat of global hegemony, as I said in the title, was a trend towards the centralization of power, towards there being a single lawgiver. And I do think that that is happening. You're seeing more and more of that on the world stage, with more and more treaties to harmonize regulations and taxation among nation states. And I think that's a very scary trend. We need to be aware of it.
Well, I'll be frank with you, Wilton. I believe that we've been pretty much effectively in that state or condition for about 55 years.
Well, it's been going on for a long time. It's not new. But I think that it is reaching a watershed point here where you're seeing not just international law, you're seeing what is supranational law, supranational authority in entities such as the World Trade Organization or the International Criminal Court, where they have the ability to make law by themselves, regardless of what individual nation states want to say. That sort of supranational power is rather new. But the tendency, certainly, I agree with you, has been there for a long time, but it's starting to get to the point where it's a little bit more ominous, that they can actually overrule what we choose to do domestically.
There's not a lot of talk about it, but ever since really the CIA was brought in, when they formed that, it's been pretty much controlled by the same people in this country ever since. I don't want to get into all the conspiracy theories and start talking about how H.W. Bush was probably behind, or involved at least in Kennedy's assassination and Bobby Kennedy and all of that. And then they, you look at all the other things that they put into place with that. They've been really pretty much unfettered in instituting all of these various things, like the United Nations and like the Department of Education. And, ever since the tax-exempt foundations got together back in the early to mid-50s, and really, Prescott Bush even started having influence when Eisenhower was in office. And it's been pretty much unfettered ever since then. So I don't believe that the votes of the people have really put presidents into place. I believe that they've known well in advance as to who was going to be president, and they manipulated it. Even Reagan was put in by the Rockefellerites and that group when they got ticked off at Jimmy Carter. I mean, and we hail him as some kind of a hero, yet, really those same powers even put him in. So I have a little bit of difficulty now when we start talking about what's happening. When I look at what's happened over the last 50 years, it seems like it's not happening now. It's been happening, and it's just now getting so brazen and so obvious that people are starting to put the pieces together.
Well, that's true. And it's funny. One of the reasons that it is getting more brazen now is precisely because that people are becoming better informed and better equipped to deal with these things. So it's caused a kind of tug of war. Technology has, through the internet and otherwise, allowed a lot of us to make our own informed decisions and not to rely on proxies in the media or in politics. And I think that has them running scared. And so they're trying even harder now to centralize their power. So the tendency definitely has always been there to control the power. But now there's a more of a sense of urgency, I think. You're seeing more and more naked attempts at seizing power because, quite frankly, it is slipping away. So on the one hand, I'm a little bit nervous about what's going on. But on the other hand, I'm optimistic because I think the Internet is something that's wonderful. It allows us to do what we're doing right now, and it allows me to post articles to Liberty Defense League and other places. So I think there is the tug of war, and so I am hopeful for the future, especially in regard to something I mentioned previously. I mentioned how secession movements are proliferating across the world stage. There is, in international law, a right called self-determination. Now, some people debate what the full scope of that means, but for the most part, people claim the right of self-determination, and they say they wish to govern themselves, and they don't want to be governed by strangers in faraway places anymore. And the United States, oddly enough, has recognized a right of secession in other countries. The United States recognized the secessionist province of Kosovo when it pulled away from Serbia. So it makes you start to really think, well, if the federal government is going to recognize secession, maybe it's something we should start considering here, too.
Is your reference going back to the Magna Carta or something more recent?
Oh, no. My book isn't as expansive as that, sorry to say. I talk about modern developments in international law. And basically, as I said, the trends that you've noticed, yes, have always been there. But I'm focusing on the accelerated trends that we're witnessing today, especially with the advent of the United Nations and a lot of the treaties that purport to protect human rights. Those are a new item on the world stage because now you have international bodies claiming to be able to govern individuals directly, to protect individuals from their own governments. And so that is a new step, having international organizations snooping around domestic sovereign territories and saying that they have the right to decide what's what, who's being treated correctly and who's being treated incorrectly.
Red, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, that's just, it is such a mass of confusion worldwide. We're doing things in other countries that are causing more confusion and chaos. And right here at home, the pressures that are building up right here in this country, it tells us that there's more confusion coming in the future. And of course, the scriptures tells us that God is not the author of confusion. So I think we have to assume that confusion it comes from other sources other than God himself, and it's not God is a God of order, and he would that we would maintain orderly societies. I really believe that the founders of this country they tried to give us a system where we the people could maintain the ultimate control. The founders knew that the election process, that vote on election day, was not going to control government. They knew what politicians, how politicians operate. They understood politicians. Since that time, politicians have become even more powerful and more effective because of all of their psychological training and all of that type of thing. But they understood that the people had to maintain the power and the control. So I want to ask Wilton how much he understands or how well he understands the 7th article of the Bill of Rights.
Oh, you're talking about the need for jury trials.
The 7th Amendment.
Yes, that is the Seventh Amendment. It guarantees the right of trial by jury in cases at common law. That is definitely probably one of the more important amendments. And strangely enough, I believe it's not one of the ones the Supreme Court has chosen to incorporate against the states. When I say that, I mean that the Supreme Court has held that the Bill of Rights, by and large, must be enforced against the state governments, even though it was designed to apply only to the federal government originally. But the Seventh Amendment, I don't think, has been enforced in that manner yet. It makes you wonder why they don't think it's as important.
The Seventh Amendment, of course, I have come to the very strong conclusion that the Seventh Amendment is by far the most important. It's far more important than the First Amendment. It's far more important than the Fourth and the Fifth, which are three amendments that are the darlings of the civil libertarians. The law schools and the legal business have tried to drop the Seventh Amendment through the cracks of time. And they've been very effective at it. I've had a number of attorneys. I've asked them about it, what they learned in law school about the Seventh. And basically, all they have learned is that it secures your right to a jury trial in a common law situation. And of course, I have carried this. I've carried this quite a ways. I sued our senior federal judge in the state of Montana back in 1993. James Batten was a lawyer. He was a congressman. He was a drunk, of course, part of it. And Nixon, President Nixon, appointed him to the federal bench in Montana. You probably aren't aware of the fact that it was the Internal Revenue Service that recruited me into the freedom movement way back in the 50s.
That is counterintuitive.
Yeah. Anyway, I had beat the IRS in some different cases, and then I filed an action against the IRS and such, and the Justice Department, they put in a motion to dismiss. Summary judgment. They wanted the judge to just kick me out of court, and which the judge did. No hearing, no nothing. And we went through three of those or more, and went to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit sat on one of them for 27 or 28 months before they finally ruled, and they ruled against me. So I sued the judge, and I put on the cover sheet. The cover of the complaint, I put there on the right-hand column, all they put is the judge's name and the number, case number. I put underneath that all facts to be tried by Seventh Amendment common law jury. That case was docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court in August of 96. In December of 96, the Solicitor General noticed all the parties to the action that he was not going to oppose me. Basically, he said I was absolutely correct in what I was saying. The government, there was no defense, no logical or proper defense that the government could come up with. That case has not been heard by the U.S. Supreme Court since then, and now we find out that there are several cases there, and I don't know what they're all about. But these are cases which are not on the computer. You can't find them. They are pigeonholed someplace, and nobody seems to know where they're at. And, of course, the federal judges are not going to tell us anything about it. You see, I've had this experience. Judge Batten, of course, has passed away. He was kind of the town drunk for about 25 years. I know a great deal about the guy. He was on record as being a spouse abuser. I knew his father-in-law very well. His father-in-law was a cattle buyer who I had done business with, and his father-in-law told me what a scumbag Jim Batten was. And here he was, a federal judge, and they named the federal building in Billings after Judge Batten after he was gone, after died. And so anyway, there's some heritage that Montana has that you need to hear about, and that is the research and the documentation of the fraud pertaining to the 16th and the 17th Amendments. I don't know, have you ever been confronted with that yourself?
I have heard arguments about how those amendments were adopted under less than, clean circumstances. I don't know much about it in detail, but I am familiar with the arguments in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to see to it that you get a copy of the book, The Law That Never Was, Volume 1. In 1980, in June of 1980, I was on the phone with a small businessman from Havre, Montana, quite late at night, and this guy is an absolute genius. He's a farmer, he's just an absolute genius. Anyway, he told me, he says, you have been speaking all over Montana and around, and he said, you say that our politicians, our public servants, lied to us about Pearl Harbor and Korea, Vietnam, Social Security, energy shortage, Watergate, Kennedy assassination, and of course I would always challenge an audience, can you point out for me any major issue in the last century that where we can know for a fact that we've been told the truth? And I've never had anybody challenge that. It's always been everybody just kind of shakes their head. Anyway, this fellow, he said, I wonder if they lied to us about the ratification of the 16th Amendment. And I hadn't thought of it. And I said, with the track record that they have and knowing the political mess that we were in at that point in our history, I have to believe that there was a fraud perfpetrated. And the fellow says, on the other end, says, we're going to find out. And they formed just an ad hoc type of thing. And they said, we're going to find out. And they contacted the archives in all the states. And in the fall of 80, they found a document called Senate Document 240. And when this fellow from Havre, Montana, analyzed it and everything, we knew without a doubt that the 16th Amendment had never been lawfully ratified. It was a total, absolute fraud. Mm-hmm. And I put that in my first book, which I wrote in 1980. It was called Born Again Republic. And then in 83, they had put a tremendous file of Senate and House debates in the states. And they collected from all of the states, of course. And I was subpoenaed in a federal case in Fort Worth, Texas, in March of 83. And that's the first that the Justice Department knew what we had done. But I was also then subpoenaed to a case in Hammond, Indiana, in June of 83. And the attorney in that case, Andy Spiegel, did a really good job of trying to get this evidence into the case. These are tax cases. And the judge looked at our evidence and said, no, he says, I won't accept it because it is not certified, which was really a Mickey Mouse excuse. The judge could have ordered the U.S. attorneys, the U.S. Justice Department, to go out and check our documents out to see if they were valid. And we could have had, all the certification we would have needed if they'd have been honest. But they weren't honest. And we sent a fellow by the name of Bill Benson. He had been a criminal investigator for the Department of Revenue for the state of Illinois. and he was a born investigator. And we spent about $100,000, and Bill Benson spent most of a year traveling to the 48 states that we had in 1913, and collected. There's over 17,000 certified documents because when Bill decided to go, when he decided to do what we needed done, I told him, I said, we want all of the documentation on the 17th Amendment, because we had discovered it too was a fraud. And these are not, these frauds are not what you would say a little bit marginal or anything. These frauds are so obvious and so numerous that, technically speaking, not one single state legislature properly ratified either the 16th or the 17th Amendments.
And just for the, I was just going to say, for the benefit of possible listeners who aren't familiar with these amendments, just briefly, of course, the 16th Amendment gave the federal government the power to tax incomes without regard to an proportional enumeration. So previously, if it was going to impose any sort of direct tax, such as an income tax, it had to be proportional according to the population of each state. And the 17th Amendment is what provided for the direct election of United States senators. Previously, they had been appointed by state legislatures, which was actually very important because the states had a direct voice and a direct role to play in the formulation of federal legislation and federal policy. The 17th Amendment cut them out of it. And it's no surprise that ever since then, the federal government has been steamrolling the states. So I'm sorry to interject like that, but those are very important and very interesting things. I'd like to learn more about them.
Yeah, well, I say it's a very important heritage in Montana, the fact that we did this. And we published this book. Bill Benson and I published this book, The Law That Never Was. It's a large hardcover book. We published it. It came off the press in April of 1985. We have not, in 25 years, we have not been able to get this before a grand jury or a petit jury or trial jury, because the roadblocks that the federal judiciary in particular and the Justice Department have put up to keep truth from the American people, they'll stoop as low as they have to go to keep this from happening. 25 years that they can cover this up, and we have sold truckloads of these books, The Law That Never Was.
I must say, it doesn't surprise me. I know that the taxing power is something the federal government guards very jealously. And
yes.
I've heard stories, I'm not very familiar with all this, but I have heard stories about people like you who have tried to publish books that are instructive on these issues, and they are hounded into submission, into not marketing or promoting that book. And so it's just one of those things where the federal government does not even want to let any sort of debate enter into the picture.
What we have done basically is we have proven that the Justice Department is not a Justice Department at all. It is an agency totally dedicated to maintaining criminal government. No ifs, ands, or buts. And you would be appalled at some of the arguments that I have heard and what I have read in their briefs and this type of thing. And of course, it's a wonder that I haven't been prosecuted, because I've done a lot of things that didn't make me a favorite of the establishment. However, when I sued the federal judge in 93, I hit on something that we should have hit on a long time before, and that is that federal judges are government agents. I have a letter that we send out thousands of copies of it are circulating all over. And I have a sentence in this letter. It says, the Seventh Amendment common law jury is the highest court in the land because even the nine justices of the U.S. Supreme Court are government agents. If they're a government employee, they are an agent of the government, are they not?
Absolutely.
Judges are making findings of fact and conclusions of law. And they have no authority to do that, whatever, because federal judges are denied impartiality in any controversy between a citizen and his government. Federal judges are government agents, and they are criminal if they have presided over any tax prosecutions and sentenced a victim to prison. This undeniable conflict of interest, and as a result, they don't mess with me because they know what they're going to be confronted with. They've had almost 20 years now since I started talking about this conflict of interest and how that we the people, one person on a jury has more power than Obama.
I was just going to say, it reminds me, my mother actually just told me recently she's getting ready to sit on a jury. She lives back in Florida. And so I gave her much the same talk that you just gave, that this is actually a great privilege if she manages to get onto the jury. And I told her something that a lot of jurors are not aware of but should be, and that is that as a juror, you have the right to judge not only the facts but the law. This is what's commonly known as jury nullification, mm-hmm. which might sound like Greek to a lot of people, but it is vital. And it has a long history in the United States. There was the famous trial, I believe in the 1730s, the colonial days, of John Peter Zenger. He was a man accused of seditious libel against the governor of his territory. I'm not sure which one it was. It might have been New York. And so he was put on trial, and under the strict letter of the law, he should have been found guilty. But the jury refused to convict him because they found the law to be unjust. And that is something that jurors need to be aware of. And sadly, the court system now is hostile to this. It doesn't mention this right to jurors, and as a matter of fact, it misleads jurors often, telling them that they must follow the law if the facts say that the law applies. And that's simply not true. So as attorneys also, we are not allowed to tell jurors this during a proceeding that we're involved in. So I try whenever I can on my own time to let people know that they do have this right, that if they think a law is unjust, it is their prerogative as jurors to say, I refuse to enforce it. And if they just give a general verdict and they say, we refuse to find the defendant guilty, then that decision cannot be challenged. It is impervious. So that is an incredible power that we have, and it's much more powerful than a regular vote. A regular vote for a politician running for office, your vote in that situation probably doesn't count for anything. But if you're on a jury of 12 or perhaps fewer people, then your vote has a good deal of importance. So I think people should use it wisely.
I'll see that you get a copy of that letter and also get a copy. I don't know if the title of or the calling this program The Walls in Our Minds, that comes from the title of one of my books. I don't know if you knew that or not.
No, I did not.
It's just the people have believed so many lies, and they've accepted them as truth. And boy, I'll tell you, when the truth comes along, then they think the truth is the lie.
Well, it's true. It's true. And actually, it's interesting. You were mentioning the 16th and 17th Amendments and how there were very suspicious circumstances. I guess, as you've said, it's confirmed to be just very, shady goings on with those amendments. The 14th Amendment itself, we were discussing that briefly before. the 14th Amendment, which is what the federal courts use to micromanage the states, itself had a very dubious birth.
Questionable.
Yeah, because, first of all,
Wilson,
I'm sorry.
Wilson,
yes.
Can you hold that thought? We can come back and talk about the 14th, 15th, 16th, and 17th when we come back, but we're going to take about a 2.5-minute break, so if you want to grab a drink of water or something, please help yourself. We'll be right back with Walls in Our Minds.
Great.
Welcome back to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here with my co-host, Red Beckman, and we have a wonderful guest tonight, Mr. Wilton Strickland, who is an author, and we were just talking about the 14th, 15th, 16th, and 17th Amendments and the fact that they are not lawfully ratified. Wilton,
you can
pick right up where you left off.
Sure. I thought that Mr. Beckman raised a very interesting point before about the 16th and 17th Amendments, and there were some suspicious circumstances surrounding their ratification. And I just wanted to pause to note that the 14th Amendment itself had very unusual circumstances surrounding its ratification as well. Basically, this was, of course, shortly after the Civil War. This is the 1860s, and you had the post-Civil War amendments. The 13th Amendment, which, of course, abolished slavery. The 14th Amendment, which had several provisions, but basically guaranteed civil rights to the newly freed slaves. And the 15th Amendment, which said that people shall not be denied the right to vote on the basis of race. Now, the 14th Amendment is interesting because the southern states, many of them were prohibited from voting on whether to adopt that amendment. Now, this is specifically forbidden by Article 5 of the Constitution. A state may not be deprived of its voice when voting on things like this. And this is even though the southern states had been allowed to vote on the 13th Amendment. But basically, the powers that be, the radical Republicans at the time, were afraid that the 14th Amendment would not be adopted, because it was going to unleash a great deal of power in the federal government to, as I said earlier, micromanage the states. And so the southern states were kept out, and they were under military rule for quite some time. And even the northern states, this is the part that's really interesting as well, even the northern states did not reach the required 3/4 majority to pass the 14th Amendment. The state of Ohio, which had originally voted in favor of the 14th Amendment, rescinded its approval. And so the 3/4 majority did not exist. Well, the rescission was ignored. And so by discounting the southern states and by discounting Ohio, it was enacted into law. And even if the 14th Amendment were validly ratified, it wouldn't justify the crazy interpretations we see in the federal courts of that amendment today. But it's just helpful to notice, if we go back to the beginning, that it wasn't even really enacted into law. It just exists by virtue of force. And it sort of opens your eyes to the nature of the system we live in. It has changed radically since the Civil War, I believe.
Well, I mean, you can't consider something ratified when it was ratified at gunpoint either. I mean, let's face it; those people were under duress. They wouldn't even reseat their legislatures until they agreed that they would ratify it. So, I mean, it was all a bogus deal. The whole thing was. But
absolutely.
On the 14th.
Absolutely.
On the other hand, look at what the judiciary has done with that. Our corrupt and compromised judiciary has. You know, even Roe versus Wade, they used the 14th Amendment as a part of the excuse for such a horrible judicial decision. And there's like four or five other significant cases that have been based on that.
And what's truly outrageous about a decision such as Roe, and there are many others like them, we could talk about just those decisions for the 2 hours and more, is that the only way the Supreme Court can honestly say that the 14th Amendment causes that kind of a result is to change the 14th Amendment. The framers of the Constitution and the framers of the 14th Amendment never could have dreamed that this is what the amendment was meant to do. So the only way the Supreme Court can go about interpreting that amendment to mean something else is not to interpret it, but to amend it. And once again, that's a power that is entrusted to the people through the representatives in Article 5 of the Constitution. Or you can have a constitutional convention among the states. But the Supreme Court has said that, well, you know, we're going to interpret it out of all meaningful existence, and it's going to mean something quite different from what it originally meant. And sadly, that's one of the first things that you are taught when you go to law school. They don't teach you in law school, when you take a constitutional law class, about the convention, about the debates, about the ratification process in the states, about what was really meant. The first thing they teach you is Marbury versus Madison, which was the 1803 decision by the Supreme Court, where the court said it had the power of judicial review to strike down laws that conflicted with the Constitution. And from there, your law school classes always focus on what the Supreme Court says, not on the actual Constitution itself. And so you have lawyers being manufactured day in and day out who have no real conception of the Constitution as a written, understandable, meaningful document. They care only about what the Supreme Court says on a given day. And so it comes as no surprise that most lawyers really are hostile to the ideas that we're talking about here. They don't care about the first principles. They care about the status quo, about the powers that be. And as it is right now, the power resides in the Supreme Court, and the Constitution has basically been rendered a dead letter, in my opinion.
When Thurgood Marshall was on the court, he has passed away, of course, he was speaking to a judicial conference in Honolulu back there, and he made a statement. He said the 14th Amendment replaced the U.S. Constitution.
Well, that was probably one of those moments of sheer honesty on his part. I mean, I don't want to trample on the man's grave. He was a great, I mean, he was a very accomplished man, and he was a Supreme Court justice. But at the same time, he was definitely one of those justices who helped to transform the Constitution from what it actually says and what it actually means into something quite different. So yeah, he probably just said what was 100% true on that occasion.
Well, rather than going off into that any further, because I think a lot of our listeners really have heard what we're talking about right now before, I'd kind of like to venture off on you. In your first book, you said preserving America in a post-constitutional age. That indicates to me that you had some ideas about some solutions on how to survive in this police state.
Yes, and I think, as I argued in the book and as I continue to argue now, I think the most important thing to do is first figure out what will not work, and then we can focus on what will. I don't think that voting for candidates to federal office is going to change anything, because the status quo has far too many vested interests in it. The way I like to describe it is this. If we were to enforce the Constitution as written and intended today, it would mean undoing probably 70% to 80% of what the federal government does. Now, there is no political constituency for that. There is no political will for that. It would mean undoing a lot of the spending that we see, which is labeled as mandatory spending for programs such as Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. People have grown dependent on those programs. And I don't think they're going to humor an argument that, well, it's unconstitutional, so we have to get rid of it. So I don't think that the ordinary political process can save us or bring us back to lawful government. It's too far gone for that. The government has power now to do what it wants, so it's not voluntarily going to surrender that power. It has it, and so it's going to keep it. So that doesn't work. Another thing that I don't think is really going to work is maybe just trying to secede right now. I don't think secession is in the cards. I think that before we could even reach something like that, there must be a sort of change on the ground. There needs to be a de facto sense of community in a given state or in a given community to govern itself, to determine its own destiny. And a big part of that has to do with federal funds. Virtually every state, almost every locality, has their hands in the government till, and they're getting government money. And once again, they're not going to want to surrender it right now. They are willing to follow along with federal policy because that's where the money comes from. So my strategy calls for, I guess, incrementalism. I try to recommend to people to get more involved, to learn about these things, and to become active in local affairs. Either run for office yourself, try to elect people to local office who share your views, and try to turn away from the federal government as much as you possibly can. I know that isn't always easy. We obviously want to pay our taxes and avoid having to go to jail, things like that. But there is a way to reclaim control of your life, to stop following everything the government does and stop thinking that you can be saved by the federal government. So my overall strategy is a sort of de facto withdrawal on the individual and local level, and hopefully one day that can lead to something even better. Sometimes it might be nullification. We've seen some of that. We've seen some nullification of federal laws. I believe the healthcare law is one example, where some jurisdictions are saying that they do not want to adopt this legislation, even though technically it is law, or it will be law very soon. And you see some of that in the drug war as well. You have states such as California or even here in Montana that resist the federal drug war. And so I think those are healthy trends, and those are the types of things I advocate. I advocate reclaiming sovereignty of yourself and of your local community and not being so focused on what's happening in Washington, D.C. I think that that's a false hope. I don't think that the Tea Party movement or any other political movement like that is going to seize control of Washington and return us to constitutional law. I don't believe that will work.
Okay, so what will work?
Well, nothing is going to work right away. There is no easy answer. I think that what will work is, again, if you work locally within your state to try to reclaim that state's own sovereignty. In other words, the state, if it has a good governor, for example, can start making decisions for itself rather than accept what the federal government says. The state could conceivably nullify a federal law or refuse to obey it. We have an example of that going on in Arizona right now because the federal courts have, for the time being, stricken down their attempt to stem the flow of illegal aliens into their jurisdiction. And so if we have a good governor in a place like Arizona, after challenging it in the courts, if that doesn't work, then the state can say, okay, thank you very much. We tried it your way. Now we're going to do things our way. We are still going to enforce our law, even if the federal government doesn't want us to. And I think that that's already taken place somewhat. I think there's the sheriff down there, or a couple of sheriffs down there, who have said that they are going to enforce this law, even though there is currently an injunction in place. So that's the type of defiance that will work. There needs to be defiance. It needs to be peaceful defiance. I'm not talking about, you know, throwing bombs or burning things up or anything like that. I'm just talking about doing what you know is right and sticking to your guns. I think that will ultimately work. If enough people see that and they see it and they follow it as an example, I think that a state or a locality can reclaim much of its own sovereignty and get itself away from federal control.
And that kind of brings us back down to your article about staying out of the federal courts. That was very interesting. I kind of wanted you and Red to have some conversation about that. Maybe you can tell Red a little bit about what that article was about and maybe Red's feedback on that.
Sure. This dovetails again with the discussion about the 14th Amendment a little bit, but basically one of the big problems we have is that even those of us who are in favor of reclaiming states' rights often are our own worst enemies. Because whenever a state or local law comes down the pike that upsets us, the first thing we do is we run to the federal courthouse and thereby, once again, give the federal government more control to decide local affairs. For example, conservatives often are happy when, we had a recent example in the McDonald decision, the Supreme Court has stricken down certain local gun regulations. Well, that might be a temporary victory, but at what cost? What you've done with a decision like that is you've given the federal government and the Supreme Court more power to decide the extent and scope of your rights. And so now there is monolithic control. You have nowhere to run. You can't move to another state as easily as you used to find laws that you like. You are now trapped by a national, one-size-fits-all set of rules. And so what you see are conservatives actually doing the work of liberal groups, such as the American Civil Liberties Union, who for the past 100 years have made an art form out of running to federal court and vetoing what people want to do in their own communities and disabling those people from controlling and seeing that their own public health, safety, and morals are governed as they see fit. So in my article, I was trying to persuade people who are liberty-minded to not rush to the federal courthouse. There are other ways you can protect your liberties. I suggested, for example, that if a state government passes a law that you think is just outrageous, it's unjust, then maybe you can challenge that law in the state court system based on the state constitution. State constitutions actually often provide more rights to the individual than the federal constitution does. So if you challenge it in the state courts, it can't be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court if you're arguing just solely matters of state law. So you can keep matters close to home that way. or you could try to get an unjust law repealed. You could, like I said, run for office or try to get candidates elected who will repeal the law. And ultimately, if you don't like it, if it doesn't work out your way and the law remains on the books, under our constitutional system, which is ingenious, you could simply move. You could easily move to another state that doesn't have that law. And by staying out of the federal courthouse, you allow different states to adopt their own laws and have true diversity. So I was trying to tell people who are liberty-minded, don't go to the courthouse. Don't go to the federal courthouse, because you're just going to wind up making things worse for yourself in the long run.
I think that, you know, I understand what you're saying, but I think that we are discovering, using the Seventh Amendment, and Rule 38 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, I think that the federal courts are probably going to be the best place to go if you can apply the seventh article of the Bill of Rights. I think that in the state courts, Some states have probably got good common law statutes, but I'm not familiar with them. I know what Rule 38 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure do, and it is being done on a very limited basis right at the moment, but I think it's going to come on much stronger here in the near future, where people are going to file an action. If you see, I'm probably getting ahead of myself here. You see, if you have a citizen out here, he's unincorporated and all, and if he ends up with a conflict with a federal agency, such as the EPA or the Fish and Wildlife Endangered Species Act and this type of thing, state court is not going to help you very much. But the seventh article of the Bill of Rights, if you invoke that and go in under Rule 38 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which provide for a Seventh Amendment common law court, and if the people will get themselves informed ahead of time, the plaintiff, so that he understands what this is all about, when he goes to court and they pick that jury, he's going to make sure that there are no government agents on that jury. There's not going to be any government employees on that jury, because the government is a party to this action, and if they're a government employee, then they become a party to the cause of the action. And
well,
so,
I will agree. I was just going to say, I will agree. If you're locking horns with the federal government or a federal agency, then by all means, go to federal court.
Yes.
My point in the article was just the narrow context of when there is a state or local law that sort of sticks in your craw, you don't like it, and you want to get it repealed. Because then if you run to federal court to veto what your fellow citizens in your state have done, I think that you're paving the way for your own destruction. But by all means, you're absolutely right. If you're involved in something serious where your rights are on the line and there's a federal agency gunning for you, then use every means at your disposal. I wouldn't encourage anybody not to do that.
Yeah. Well, of course, this is kind of dear to my heart for the simple reason that I've been involved in it, more so than on the state level. I had sued the State Department of Revenue for the state of Montana in 77, and I won that case. And I didn't know that much about the law, but I won the case. And I look back, and I'm amazed at what happened. But, you know, most of the controversies that you're going to end up with are going to be federal versus the citizen. Of course, if you're a real estate developer like Terry, you're going to run into Colorado statutes Colorado law. And so, you know, you'd have to check your Montana or your Idaho, check your Colorado law to see what they provide in the way of common law courts.
I understand. And I would just say to people that yes, use the federal courts if you need to, and especially if the federal government is involved. But for purposes of just trying to maintain the integrity of state laws in general, try to avoid the federal courthouse if there's a particular state law.
I agree. I agree totally.
Yeah, because all you're going to wind up doing is making it easier for the federal courts to get involved in every manner of dispute. Once they might have helped you out in your dispute, they're going to be there tomorrow to hurt you. So, and we've seen it time and time again with these ridiculous rulings. They just keep coming and coming. So it's only going to get worse if we keep acting this way and being dependent on the federal government for salvation.
I'm sure glad you're in Montana.
Oh, I am too. I am too. I have to tell you.
We need you in Montana, and I hope you can, sit down with some other attorneys in the state. I'm sure that they're there that are just like me. I'm not an attorney, but I'm glad you're there. And I have a hunch there'll be some attorneys in Montana that are going to be real happy to have you there. And hopefully you'll get an opportunity to communicate, through your bar association or whatever, with the other attorneys, because there is quite a frustration there with the attorneys and what's happening to them in the federal court system.
Well, I look forward to it, and I've already met a lot of good attorneys. As a matter of fact, when I was here for the bar exam back in February, I met my current employer, and we hit it off so well that I got my job offer on that same trip. So automatically I knew that this was the place for me. You have very friendly people here in Montana, so it's been wonderful. But I must admit, it is difficult to find attorneys pretty much anywhere who are sympathetic to the ideals of limited government and things of this nature. I don't know necessarily why that is. It might have to do with modern legal education or any number of things, but it can be hard. So I'm hoping here in Montana I can find more than I had found back in Florida, because there were very few back there.
Yes. Are you familiar with Edwin Vieira, the attorney
Yes, I have heard that name, but I couldn't tell you exactly why I'm familiar with it, but I am familiar with the name.
Yeah, he's
We'll try to get you more familiar with Dr. Edwin Vieira. Vieira has argued four cases before the Supreme Court. He's considered probably our best expert on sound money or gold, electronic transfer, that sort of thing. The bills that have been introduced around the states have all been authored by him, and he's also the expert on well-regulated state militia. He and Red are both the ones that have put out the best books out there. Red thinks his is better because it doesn't take four Harvard degrees to understand it. But
it's true. Law actually is not as complicated as a lot of lawyers and law professors would have you believe. They like to make it that way because it makes their services more valuable, but it's actually not that complicated.
Gentlemen, we've had a question in the chat about the Rule 38. Can you guys, Red, you might want to elaborate, and then perhaps you'd jump in there too, Wilton, on the threat to the judges.
Rule 38 provides for a Seventh Amendment common law jury trial, and of course, there's very few attorneys that are familiar with Rule 38. The legal profession as a whole don't want you to know about Rule 38. Now, if you have somebody that is strong-willed and able to speak and not be intimidated by a judge, in that common law court, the judge is pretty much neutralized. You need that judge sitting on that bench. You need him there. He belongs there. He has a right to be there. He has a job to do. He has the responsibility to maintain the order in that court. But he cannot make findings of fact or conclusions of law. If you're in a conflict between a government agency of one kind or another, if you're suing a government agency, this is where this Rule 38 and the Seventh Amendment is going to come in real strong, is where the people have been damaged. They've been hurt financially or whatever, and by the actions of a federal agent, and they sue that agent with a Title 42, which gives them the chance to sue them for damages to make themselves whole again if they've been damaged. And if you've got a plaintiff that goes in there and he's well spoken, respected in his community and all, he can see to it that that jury is not made up of a bunch of government employees, which is what the government likes to do. They like to have cases where they can stack the deck. I think that the Justice Department attorneys are the scum of the earth. They're surely the scum of the legal profession. I've had some lengthy conversations with some of them, and they agree with me when I tell them some of the things that I know of. Anyway, the plaintiff can educate that jury. Once he has that jury sitting there in the jury box, he can educate that jury about their power. He can explain to them how that they are a higher court than the Supreme Court of the United States. They're a higher court than the appellate courts. And the judge is going to have to sit there and basically agree with what the plaintiff is telling the jury. And so when the case is heard, there's none of this one attorney just stacking the deck. He's one of the good old boys, probably went to law school with the judge and such, and he objects to somebody's testimony, and the judge says objection is sustained. The judge can't do that because he can't make a finding of fact or a conclusion of law. He has to let that witness testify. And so, you know, the plaintiff is the guy that wrote the complaint. He's the one that's been damaged. He knows that case better than anybody. A lawyer cannot argue that case for him. A lawyer cannot represent him. The lawyer, he's going to have a lawyer, he's going to want one, he should have one, sitting at his elbow, helping him to formulate his questions and such. But the plaintiff has to speak for himself. He's there in person, and what happened to him. If he breaks down and cries because of what has happened to him, that's just great, because that jury, they'll see through it if it's phony. That jury is a lot smarter than what people think. Sure, they may be just common people. They may not know law, but they will. They have a talent for analyzing people, the witnesses, as to their sincerity, their honesty, all of that. It all plays into it. And so the Seventh Amendment common law jury trial is something that I think we're going to see. It is happening on a limited basis already, but I think as the word gets out and as people become more familiar with it, I think it's going to be used extensively, and it's going to cause government agents to be a little more careful in how they confront the sovereign citizen. that jury of 12 in that common law court, they're all going to realize that they are sovereign, and they're going to have that term sovereign, that word sovereign, that's going to be explained to them. They're going to understand what it means to be sovereign. It means to have the final say on the law. That's what a sovereign is. And so I'm real optimistic about the future of our justice system, because they have become so corrupt that they're getting an awful lot of people to recognize their corruption, and people that are going to want to do something about it.
Well, that's an excellent explanation, and the only thing I can really add is that it's true the jury trial is very well established in American law, fortunately for us, and I don't think there's any realistic movement afoot to get rid of it. The only danger is the attempts by the courts and by a lot of people in government is to misinform the jury or to keep people in general uninformed about the full scope of their rights as jurors. And it is very difficult as an attorney to fully inform the jurors of what their powers are, because courts often will not allow you to tell the jurors that they have the right to nullify the law if they disagree with it. And the court will instruct them in the exact opposite way. The court will tell the jurors that they must apply the law if they find that the law fits the facts. And so jurors need to know before they get to the courthouse that they don't necessarily have to do that. So it's incumbent on all of us who are aware of these issues to try to spread that knowledge, because the juror who gets selected for jury duty, he might not receive that information on the day in question, and he might not be able to discharge his duties.
Don't be surprised if you get a package. I'll get your address off the internet, and send you a sample of my books, because this is what I address. I've been addressing this jury nullification thing for many years, and I hope you contact the Fully Informed Jury Association in Helena. You can look up the Fully Informed Jury on Google, and they have a phone number, an 800 number and such. You contact them, and they'll send you a package free of charge. And
oh, great.
Of course, I recommend that people send them a $10 bill, because the information they get will do more than, is worth more than 10 bucks. But it's free, and they don't ask for any funds. It's rather interesting. They have been underfinanced for many years. They were formed in 1989, but here in the last few months and such, their financial situation has improved immensely. But they will send these packages out, and you'll find them very, very fascinating. They've got some beautifully well done brochures on different subjects, and I hope you get a chance to meet the executive secretary, Ela Jones. She's a very sharp gal, and they're active. They're busy, and it's a national organization. They've got their coordinators, I think, in every state, and some states are more active than others, of course.
And it's funny, I actually would enjoy being on a jury very much, but in all likelihood, that's not going to happen, because as an attorney, I probably scare the attorneys on that case. I had the opportunity once when I was in Miami, I lived there for about 5 years, to sit on a jury in a drunk driving case. Nothing really exciting, but I wanted to be on the jury, and I wanted to hear the facts and try to decide the case properly. And they went through the voir dire process, which is when they try to vet the jurors for any potential bias or anything else that might be disfavorable to that person's case. And I just answered fairly, honestly. I was neutral on everything. I had no prejudgment about guilt or innocence, but I surely wasn't picked. So I would love to do it someday. I probably won't, but I hope for everybody else out there, if you do get the opportunity to serve on a jury, you should really take advantage of it and not be upset or depressed. I know sometimes people get upset because it takes away from work and whatnot, but it really is a unique opportunity when you can make a real good difference for somebody's life. So please embrace it, and I'll just have to live vicariously through you because it's probably not going to happen to me.
Yeah, we haven't talked much about the grand jury, but the grand jury, of course, is, I've always called the grand jury the detergent in our political system. It's their responsibility to keep it clean, to stay in tune with what's going on. I tell people that the situation that we had, the terrible atrocity of Waco, Texas, with the Branch Davidians, would never have happened if the people knew about their power on a grand jury. Texas is strong on grand juries at the county level. I'm not sure how many grand juries that county has, but I wouldn't be surprised if they have 3 or 4 grand juries. They'll have a grand jury sitting every week. They alternate. And you see, if on that Sunday when the ATF had their raid, the word got around the county very rapidly. And those people on those grand juries, you see, at least one of those grand juries, somebody should have woke up and said, wait a minute, we've got to get involved in this. And if they'd called around to the others on the grand jury and such, and then perhaps got themselves together for a little bit at McDonald's restaurant or someplace, they can meet any place. And it was a Sunday evening, and they could have, when they agreed to what they were going to do, they could have picked up the phone and called the local sheriff and said, Sheriff, the grand jury number such and such is going to meet tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. And we'll be at some restaurant or someplace, and we want you there at 6:15. Then they call the county attorney and they say, we want you to meet with the grand jury tomorrow morning at 6:30. We're going to be there. The sheriff is going to be there, and we're ordering you to be there. Then they call the attorney general for the state of Texas, and they say, the grand jury number such and such in Waco, we have started a process here where we're going to investigate what the BATF did to the Branch Davidians today, and we want you here in the morning at 7 o'clock to meet with this grand jury. And they might even subpoena the governor. But there would not have been 80 people murdered by a criminal government if the grand jury in that any one of those grand juries, those county grand juries, had been functioning, if they had known. Now, I tell people that the three greatest words in the English language is, I love you. And the saddest three words is, I didn't know. And so this is how important that grand jury is, and these are sovereigns that sit on that jury. They don't have to allow a county prosecutor to browbeat them or tell them what they're going to do. They tell the county prosecutor, they tell the county attorney or the district attorney what he is supposed to do and what they are ordering him to do, and he better follow the orders. And so this is another aspect of this this system that we were given back there those many years ago, that it was made to survive if we the people maintain our positions as sovereigns.
Well, it's true, and I believe it was John Adams who said that the Constitution was designed for a moral and religious people, and that it can't possibly function for another type of people. So I think we mentioned this earlier, but those are sort of the first principles that undergird our constitutional system, because Only a moral and religious people, in my view, are capable of the self-restraint it takes to have an established system of rules that everybody plays by. The grand jury is one very important part of that. The grand jury says something, you've got to do it. But that type of ability to follow the rules and to do what's right, regardless of how inconvenient it might be, is something that only a moral and religious people are capable of. And so I do fear sometimes that on a cultural level, we're seeing a lot of that starting to erode. A lot of people aren't aware of America's history, and to the extent they are aware of it, they tend to criticize it, scorn it, and say that, oh, well, we're superior now. They were a bunch of evil slaveholders back then. And nobody's perfect. The Founding Fathers weren't perfect, but they were, by and large, a people that understood the importance of first principles. And I think that we can learn from their example. So I think that programs like this are great. They help people become more aware of these things. And I'm going to try harder in my own life to have conversations with people like this, because a lot of times you get into your routine and you don't talk about these important things. But they are important. So I think everybody who might be listening needs to be aware of this and try to share your ideas with other people. That's how change is really going to happen for the better.
Well, we have quite a group of listeners, especially tonight. I think we've got a very astute group of people that are actually even participating in chat. I don't know if you're online and can see that, but there's been a pretty good conversation going on in our chat room tonight. But we have a really, really great group of really loyal listeners that listen to us on a regular basis and even communicate with us off the show. And that's one of the reasons why we feel good about having some of these conversations on a fairly deep level. We can move at a pretty rapid pace here, and most of our listeners get it.
Well, we certainly have covered a lot of ground. I mean, we've talked about the Constitution, international affairs, and moral and religious people. So, yeah, this has been wonderful. I don't have conversations like this very often, so I'm very glad that you have invited me onto the show. This is nice.
Well, we've got about 8 minutes left. One of the things you might want to do is tell people how to get a hold of your books.
Sure. My books should be available at Amazon.com, and they're available on any number of other internet sites where books are sold. So if you just type in unlawful government, probably in quotes, but even if not, it might work, you should see a bunch of those links pop up. So please feel free to take a look at the book, and if it intrigues you at all, feel free to buy it. And read Liberty Defense League, because that's a website I try to post at on a regular basis. And there's a lot of other good writers there as well, including Timothy Baldwin. He's a very articulate young man, and it's a wonderful site. And there are a lot of good resources out there, and it doesn't take much effort to get them. So, you know, I hope all of you can read some of this stuff and get some of ideas of your own and maybe contribute to the debate.
Red, how about you take a couple of minutes? One of the things I wanted to suggest, Red, is that you may want to hook Wilton up with your buddy. It's got the library there in Montana. How far is he from Missoula? Sam's who I'm talking about.
Sam has moved to Idaho, and I don't know exactly where. He has not contacted me. This is a gentleman that he's an absolute genius, and he's the one that he's the one that I was on the phone with, and he said, "Do you suppose they lied to us about the 16th Amendment ratification?" And he has a library, a law library, and he's not a lawyer. But he has a law library that goes way, way, way back. It was given to him back in the early 80s by a lawyer at Butte, Montana, who he was well up in years. I think he was well into his 80s when he gave Sam his collection because he found out what Sam was doing in the way of research and such. And that law library has got a lot of law books that go clear back into the 1800s. And Sam has, I don't know how to say it, but this guy, he had a large farm operation up in Montana, and he has sold it and moved to Idaho, and I'm sure that collection has gone with him. When I first met him, of course, he was a young guy in his 30s. Now he's well into his 60s. He has so much to contribute. There's people that go there from around the nation and spend 2 or 3 days with him, and they'll go through all this stuff, and there's stuff I don't want to bring up on the program here because it's in such depth and such that I just I wouldn't dare bring it up, saying things that he has found out about our history in this country and what, you know, was taking place in the past. You know, people are always telling me, they say, we've got the worst government that we've ever had in our history. We've got the most corruption. We've got, and they're talking about cities, counties, states, and the federal government. And I say, no, we don't have the worst government ever. Because after the Civil War, and even before the Civil War, we had a lot of corruption, bad, serious things happening. And the first 50 years of our existence as a nation were pretty shaky. There was a lot of major questions that were bouncing around and such. And then after the Civil War, of course, you had the incorporation of Washington, D.C. and all of that. Back there in the, if people have access to the congressional record, I don't know if they still have that at the University of Montana Law Library there. Wilton, you'll probably be in there. You've probably been there already.
As a matter of fact, I'm going to be there spending some time soon because I'm helping coach one of the school's moot court teams. So I look forward to getting more familiar with the law school and seeing if those materials are indeed there.
Yeah, well, back in 86, 87, I spent quite a bit of time there, and I got copies of a lot of the congressional record. It was one of the very few libraries in the country that still had the physical copies of the congressional record going back there, because most of them had gone to the photocopies and the I can't even think of the word.
The microfiche.
So what
was it?
Microfiche.
The microfiche.
Yeah. And so it was a great place, to do the kind of research that we were doing, but that was for a second book. And it was corrupt. And this is why Montana, for one state, Montana, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon, Wyoming, the Dakotas, these were states that were brought into the Union, actually prematurely, at least in my opinion, because the state legislatures were appointing the U.S. senators. And we had the robber barons that were so dominant in this country at that point in time, the 1890s and 1910. They were able to buy seats in the U.S. Senate. So that they could control the U.S. Senate. They didn't really care about the state the legislature. They didn't care about the House that much. But they were able to control the U.S. Senate and keep a lot of good legislation from being passed. And, of course, I see where we're running out of time here, but that's some more history that's really fascinating. And you've got a rare opportunity there if they've still got those volumes there, the original volumes of the congressional record. I don't remember exactly how far they go back, but I did know at one time. But I hope they're still there for your use.
Oh, I hope so, too, because it is very eye-opening if you go directly to those primary sources. Instead of relying on some secondhand analysis, you will see exactly what happened, and I've experienced some of that with the notes I referred to earlier of the Federal Convention. When you read the actual debates that took place, it makes you realize that things could have been very different. There were people there, for example, who wanted to abolish the states, who wanted to have a single a single uniform national government. So these sorts of debates have been going on forever, and you could say that we're on borrowed time, that those people who lost the initial debate are sort of prevailing now.
Well, gentlemen, now, we are out of time.
Wilson, thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
I sure thank you for coming on.
We'll have you back.
All right. Take care.
Bye now. Good night, everybody. See you next week.
Yep. Bye.
You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You might be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're going to have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed. You're going to have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. Maybe a rock and roll addict dancing on the stage. Money, drugs at your command. Women in a cage. You may be a businessman or some high degree thief. They may call you doctor or they may call you chief. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody. You may be blind or lame, maybe living in another country under another name, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Maybe be living in a mansion, you might live in a dome. You may own guns and you may even own tanks. You may be somebody's landlord, you may even own banks. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yeah, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
You may be a preacher, spiritual pride. Maybe a city councilman taking bribes on the side. Maybe working in a barber shop, you may know how to cut hair. It may be somebody's mistress, maybe somebody's heir. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you're gonna have to
serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Might like to wear cotton, might like to wear silk, might like to drink whiskey, might like to drink milk. Might like to eat caviar, you might like to eat bread. Maybe sleeping on the floor, sleeping in a king-size bed. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Bobby, or you may call me Zimmer.
And it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.